She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for joining me today. And remember that tagline, we don't want to tell you what to think, we just want you to. So important in our crazy world today. This show is sponsored by Chapman Tucson, and we always give a shout out to them because we're grateful for their support in helping the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network be. So I have to take a little bit of a deep breath or two about this show today, and I'll explain why in a minute. My guest is Chris Jordan. He's an internationally acclaimed, or I would say recognized, applauded environmental photographer, and soon to be a very famous filmmaker. Chris, I'm going to do that shout out for you. And I can't wait to get to the interview, so just bear with me for a minute. And Chris, thanks for being here. Before we get the show to topic and interviewing you, I want to remind everybody again that Golden Eagle Distributors, who is one of the supporters of Mrs. Green's World and one of the greatest, greenest companies in the entire Southwest because of what they're doing in sustainability leadership, and Anheuser-Busch are partnering to promote World Environment Day through something that I find to be quite amusing, Grow One, Save a Million campaign, as in grow a beard. And if you're a regular listener to my show, you know that clean water, not wasting water, respecting our access to practically free water is a top issue for me. So I'm really happy to help promote this campaign for them. And believe it or not, an average guy, not my average guy, uses 5 gallons of water every time they shave, which now that I know about water shortages is rather upsetting. So Budweiser is trying to get people to be aware to not waste water anytime. So check out their Facebook page. It's quite cute. Grow One, Save a Million. And then please don't forget to listen to me every Saturday at 12 at MrsGreensWorld.com. And reminding you, you can listen to me on your iPhone or Droid because I am so modern. And if you do miss the show, all my shows live on my website right there for your listening pleasure at MrsGreensWorld.com. So, Chris, is it okay if I tell a very short story about how our lives started to intersect almost 4 years ago?
Well, I can't remember the story, so I'll just have to trust you.
Trust me. You have never heard the story. So I was, and part of what in reading about your journey and having it find you was the Mrs. Green's World, the birth of Mrs. Green and it finding me. But I was thinking about starting a radio show, no background in media, social services, and I watched the Bill Moyer show that you did about waste and environmental waste. And I was like, there's so more to this that has to be done. And I've got to decide my contribution. Within a week, I met a woman named Janet Ray, who had been at Storyfield with you in Colorado. And I said, there's this amazing photographer named Chris Jordan. She looked at me and she said, are you making this up? And I said, no. And she said, I just spent a week with him in Colorado at something called Storyfield. And then quickly thereafter, I went to a workshop called Awakening the Dreamer, Changing the Dream, and met another woman named Emily Brichard, who was also there. So that's where I connected with Chris Jordan, and you didn't know it. But I had to share it on the show today.
Oh, what a delight to hear that.
I know.
The Storyfield conference was life-changing for me, and the kind of way my work has spiraled and snowballed since then has been really astonishing.
And it was only a one-time conference. I think that's really sad. I mean, and it was about how you are going to write your own story. Isn't that right? If I recollect, it's about what story are you going to write and taking it to the next level.
Yeah, that conference sort of looked at the same issues that I'm trying to look at with my own work, which is the intersection of our individual personal stories and the kind of greater story of humanity right now, and how does each one of those things influence the other, and how do we empower ourselves as individuals to shift the big story.
And your journey, though, I think it's great to paint a picture to our listeners about the background, is that you were really, you loved color. I remember this. And you started photographing things to just see beautiful color in things like, you know, storage containers and focusing on that. And then friends of yours started talking to you about waste and American consumerism. And you said, and I did take this quote, it's something that I truly cannot take credit for, although I think that's arguable, is finding my way to consumerism as my subject because it found me. So talk about the beginning of that journey and that transformation and how it ignited your passion.
Well, I come from a family of artists and have been pretty fascinated and passionate about photography for a very long time, ever since sometime back in high school. But the kind of the roots of my interest in photography way back then was in the kind of photography that's called formalism, which is basically just pure art for the sake of art, for the sake of beauty. And you know, my dad was a photographic collector, and he had a house full of books of the work of people like Edward Weston. And strangely enough, one of Edward Weston's most influential photographs on me many, many years ago was his picture of a dead pelican in the sand on the beach at Point Lobos. And there's a sort of mysticism in his work that I always really connected with. But at the same time, Edward Weston and Ansel Adams and the kind of American, the Western American school of photography at the time were heavily criticized by people like Henri Cartier-Bresson, who said that, you know, during, there was a world war going on, and Henri Cartier-Bresson said of Edward Weston, the world is going to hell and he's taking pictures of rocks. And but that's just, that's what I grew up on, is that kind of photography. And so that's what my own work was about. It was just making beautiful compositions and celebrating gorgeous textures. And I was particularly interested in color. And so I built my whole photographic practice around just diving deeply into the complexity and intricacy and beauty of color. And one of the places where I found the most fascinating, beautiful, intricate color was in giant piles of garbage in the port of Seattle. And, what I was interested in was when you stood back at a distance from these huge piles of garbage, it almost looked like an impressionist painting. You know, there's just this incredibly complex and beautiful palette of colors. And then when you realize what you're looking at, it's this giant pile of garbage. It was kind of a fascinating exercise in aesthetics and color for me. And it was other people, and specifically my dear friend and mentor, Phil Borges, who's an amazing, dedicated photographer. He came over to my studio one day, and he looked at my pictures, and he said, well, you know, I love talking about color, and you're hearing your whole color theory, but what I see when I look at these photographs is a macabre portrait of America.
Unbelievable. Said, so true. Okay.
Sorry.
I said so true. It was looking through another pair of eyes.
Yeah, and he it was him that sort of, he said, I see a really powerful thread here that's kind of cutting edge. And so he urged me to follow that thread. And that was the beginning of sort of diving deeply into the subject of mass consumption rather than focusing all my interest and attention on color. But I didn't want to let go of it because the aesthetics and the beauty of photographic formalism is so powerful to draw the viewer in. And I learned that there have been lots of other photographers, such as Richard Mizrak, whose work I have tremendous respect and admiration for. He's been using the beauty of formal landscape aesthetic for many, many years as a sort of seductive device to draw the viewer in to an uncomfortable conversation with himself about the state of our world. And so I kind of have worked with that, you know, worked with beauty as a tool instead of merely as an end in itself.
You know, one of the things that I've been thinking about this interview literally for about 3.5 years about why it hooked me so powerfully. And to me, when you, I do a lot of public speaking, I present, you know, to Rotary clubs and other groups, and I use a PowerPoint sometimes. What your photographs do, as far as I'm concerned, is they're, it's just the facts. It's like climate change without controversy, because in some cases I'll be going into a group where I know they have a predisposition. Oh, here comes the environmentalist. And I start now with your photograph of the first one of Midway, and nobody moves. And I said, so where is your bottle cap? That's a lot about what I want to talk to you about today. And I get people's attention. And then I, you know, quickly move to running the numbers, because they're just facts that you report. So to me, the passion that you have for exposing it is there. And I get to see the reaction on people's faces as I show the first slide. And people, I don't want to make people feel guilty ever, or sad, or shamed. I just want them to engage in critical thinking about where they're putting their waste, because as Julia Butterfly Hill said, there is no more away. So, okay, so how did you move from these, you know, the impact that Phil and other people had on you to putting, was your first exhibit Running the Numbers, Portraits of Mass Consumption?
Well, there was a whole body of work that came before that. You know, before I answer that, I just wanted to make a comment about sort of presenting the facts, because it's a beautiful way to say it. And what I'm trying to do with all of my work, all of the different bodies of work, all have this same thread that goes through them, and it is exactly, I'm trying to report the facts, but there are two different facts that get included in every image. And it's kind of two different ways you can see the world. One of the facts is, this is, here's something horrible that's going on.
Right.
You know, whether it's a photograph of a dead baby albatross filled with plastic, or a giant pile of our garbage, or the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, or a dead elephant in Kenya that has been killed by poachers. Like, every single image has this sort of documentary, factual exposition of a horror. And I also try to include in every image another kind of fact, which is that we live in an incomprehensibly beautiful and mysterious world. And so I try to wrap my work in this envelope of beauty, because that to me is equally as important of a fact as all the problems of our world. It's like these two different ways, these two different perspectives that you can look at our world from, and I want to hold them both. You know, like, I don't want to only focus on all of the problems. I want to focus on the mystery and the beauty and the wonderment of the miracle, and sort of bring those two things together like opposite ends of a magnet until they touch, and you almost can't even tell which one is which anymore.
And to me, you, I'm on the other end of it. You do that because you, as daunting as they are, they inspire me to act. And the way that I go about life is, if they're inspiring me to act, I can present it that way and it will inspire others. It's just about getting their attention and getting their consciousness. And I could not agree with you more. I mean, one of my taglines when I first started the show is, my show is about a world full of hope, possibility, and change, because we can all do that. And with your raising the awareness in such a stark way, and I think that's a really good word, it does get people's attention, but it doesn't leave me feeling hopeless ever. So mass consumption is people. And to me, the people, that's what my goal is. By spreading the word on the green airwaves, is we can shift the planet, because I have guests, I have people on my show like you that really hold the same intention, which is the beauty and the hope for it. So the background of the work was there. And then Tell me, I'd love to know a little bit about the compilation of running the numbers. I'd even like to know, the statistics are ones that are very impressive, very important. Where do you, I don't even know where you get the, what's the source? How do you know that we consume, you know, 60,000 plastic bags every 5 seconds, and the plastic water bottle consumption, and the cell phones, and the phone cords? What's, how do you do your sourcing? Because that's a huge amount of work in and of itself, not to mention the products, your gorgeous works of art.
Well, I'm an artist, and we get to create things, and so I just make all those statistics up.
Oh, yeah. That is just not a good answer. No, you do not, because
I researched them just a journalist would, and it's really interesting to dive into these issues. You know, every time I do a Running the Numbers piece, I really immerse myself in the issue, and for example, like the piece that I did that I called Gyre, and there's several pieces that I've done around ocean plastic pollution.
Right.
What I to immerse myself in that issue is I connected with a group of ocean scientists around the world who are all meeting and studying the issue, and I attended some meetings, and got to meet all of the leading ocean scientists in the world who are studying plastic and ocean currents, and so I really get to find out what's the cutting edge of estimates of the amount of plastic in the ocean, and just sort of learn the iconography of the subject and try to figure out ways to build some of that in multiple layers of meta message into each one of the pieces. And it's difficult because a lot of these, a lot of the things are, they're estimates. You know, the amount of plastic entering our world's oceans or the number of cell phones that are discarded every day.
Right.
And when you dive all the way in and look, it gets much more complicated. And the most complicated one I've ever looked at that I couldn't, I ended up not being able to do a Running the Numbers piece about it because there was no defensible number. And that was a piece that I really wanted to do soon after then President Bush did his aircraft carrier photo opportunity and said mission accomplished. At the time, the best estimate of the number of Iraqi civilians who had been killed in the Iraq invasion, but the number was so squishy, the best estimate was 1 million, but the standard deviation was 80%.
Oh my gosh.
Which meant that it could have been close to 2 million or it could have been 200,000, but the best estimate was 1 million. And I just, there was no number that I could defend, and it's so important for me to have a number that I can really rely on. And I always choose the conservative side because the numbers are so huge, and especially when you see it visualized, it's so shocking that people want to attack my numbers.
Right. So they focus
on, a lot of
right.
times, you know, people will write and say, we couldn't possibly be using that much office paper in the United States every year, because that would be like 500 sheets per person, including all the newly born infants. And so a lot of times people do attack the statistics behind my work, but I've never had somebody come and say, you got the number wrong, and here's the right number, and here's the backup for that. And so it's really, it's the whole conversation around the accuracy of the statistics behind my work is really interesting, because it kind of illustrates to me the disconnect that we have with these giant numbers. Because if you were to just read in an article on the internet that every year in the United States we use 210 billion plastic bottles.
Right.
And you just sort of like, your mind says, okay, well, 300 million people using 200 billion plastic bottles in 365 days. Like, you need to try to figure out, well, is that too much? You know, is like, how many is that?
Yeah, and then they can look at your website and see a picture of it or one of your exhibits. I'm working on doing a video for YouTube with a really great creative human being here in Tucson that's won some Addy Awards on plastic bags, because that happens to be one of my passions. And we're thinking about calling it the silent killer, because I want to get attention, I admit it, but again, we want to show the beauty and the opportunity. And boy, oh boy, is he like you in that the data, the statistics, he wants the facts, he wants sources, he doesn't want us to get in any trouble. Okay, we are going to have to go to a short break. Please stay here with me. I'm sure if you're listening, you'll want to. We're interviewing Chris Jordan, internationally acclaimed environmental photographer and game changer for the planet. We will be right back.
Can you predict the future? The reality is we can't, but we can be ready for it. Funded by the National Science Foundation, researchers at the University of Arizona are working on a $3 million project to study the monsoon and learn about our changing desert weather, climate, and ecology. Such knowledge will help guide us to a more sustainable future, not just for our desert, but for the world. Now that's thinking ahead. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
She's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you, and you want to spend eternity with her. She deserves nothing less than the best, an Abbott Taylor original. A diamond engagement ring as exceptional as she is that will make her eyes sparkle every time she sees it. Because we design and make our own jewelry, we can create something wonderful for every budget. I'm Abbott Taylor. I'd like to invite you to come see what Abbott Taylor Jewelers has waiting for you. With 35 years and thousands of original jewelry designs, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. We're proud to say using recycled gold, we have saved over 100 million pounds of toxic waste from this planet. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. Did you know that the 2012 VW Beetle has been completely redesigned, that it has exciting new features, look, and performance, and that it is one of Oprah's best things for 2012? The best news is Chapman VW has them in stock. Check out the new Beetle at Chapman VW at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan, or visit them at TucsonVW.com. Be sure to tell them that Mrs. Green sent you.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill, but I have a bigger reason to give. My brother, Jim. When Jim was just 6 weeks old, he had a stroke. He had to rewire his brain to do most things we all take for granted. Thanks to Goodwill, Jim has a job and a sense of purpose. You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill is the best thing that ever happened to Jim. Please donate today.
Budweiser is asking guys to skip shaving leading up to World Environment Day. Not only can guys get an extra 5 minutes of sleep in the morning, they can save about 5 gallons of water for each shave they skip. Our goal is to save 1 million gallons of water. Help us by going to Budweiser's Facebook page and making a pledge. You can actually do less and help make a difference. So join us and grow one. Save a million.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And we are certainly creating a lot of opportunities for you to think with us today. Joining us is Chris Jordan, environmental photographer, filmmaker, and very clearly an overall game changer for raising awareness for the planet. Thank you for joining me. And don't forget to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. If you have any questions about today's show, you know we want to answer them. info@mrsgreensworld.com. And this podcast will be available shortly after it's aired at mrsgreensworld.com. So, Chris, thank you again for being here with us. So this segment, I'd love to talk about Midway, about how it came about and what led you to Midway and your team to do the important work that you're doing there. Because that, to me, I think, arguably, might be one of the most inspirational clips I've ever watched inspiring me to change my habits. I haven't thrown a bottle cap away in 4 years, and Mr. Green is my witness. We take them to a place that recycles them, and I've checked that out. So let's talk about Midway. I think it's one of your major passions and clearly important for all of us on the planet.
Well, it's been a life-changing experience for me that has the story of Midway and the process that I've been going through there is something that really doesn't feel like it's coming from me at all. It's coming to me.
I agree. I get that. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I first went there after one of the meetings that I was in trying to learn about the Pacific Garbage Patch. And I was sitting with a group of scientists, and the reason that I had gone to this particular meeting is because I was hoping to get myself onto a research boat that was going to the middle of the Pacific Garbage Patch so I could take a photograph of the horizon-to-horizon floating patch of garbage that I thought existed.
Right.
Because, remember, that's kind of the meme that got put out there early on when people were first studying the Pacific Garbage Patch, as that it's a floating island of trash in the Pacific Ocean that's twice the size of Texas.
Right, right. That went viral.
When I first heard that, the citizen in me, my heart sank with despair, and the photographer in me felt a kind of excited glee of the, because, you know, I'm the guy who takes photographs of giant piles of garbage.
Right, and, you got to show everybody. Right.
Yeah, I imagined going to the middle of this giant pile of garbage and climbing to the top of the mast of the boat and taking a panoramic photograph that would blow people's minds. And I learned at this meeting, with talking with the world's leading scientists who are studying it, that there really is no Pacific Garbage Patch, at least not in the way that we think of it. Most of the plastic is underwater. It's in the water column,
right,
as deep as 600 feet deep, depending on the density of the particular kind of plastic. And most of it is broken down into infinitesimally tiny pieces that are smaller than the naked eye can see. And so what these scientists were telling me is that there's millions of tons of plastic in the Pacific Ocean and pouring out of our rivers from all the continents that border the Pacific Ocean all the time. And yet it's an invisible issue because there's nowhere you can go and see it. If you float a boat to the very middle of the Pacific Garbage Patch, all you see is the wide open blue Pacific. And I was lamenting at that, saying, you know, I'm a photographer. I want to take a photograph of the Pacific Garbage Patch. And this young woman named Anna Cummins, who herself is an incredibly inspirational activist on the issue, she turned to me and she said, well, I was an intern out on Midway Island, and I can tell you, if you want to see the Pacific Garbage Patch in person, go to Midway Island and look inside the stomachs of dead baby albatrosses.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
And that was just stunning to me. And she showed me some photographs. It's the strangest thing. There were a whole bunch of photographs, maybe 25 or 30 photographs up on the internet at the time of dead baby albatrosses with their bodies all filled up with plastic. And I looked at them, and they were just kind of wank snapshots. You know, they weren't photographs that were really made with intention and reverence.
Right.
And it was so surprising to me to see that there was all these photographs up on the internet, and no, it hadn't made it into the public consciousness, really. That this stunningly horrible and symbolic tragedy was happening in this incredibly remote place. And so I decided to go there. And I made this series of photographs the first time in 2009 of, you know, there were tens of thousands of dead baby albatrosses on the ground, and their stomachs were filled just with absolutely surreal amounts of plastic. And then when I came back after making those photographs, and I put them up on my website, and that work went far more viral than any of my previous work. It reached a huge audience around the world. And the response that I got really broke my heart, because some people received the work the way you do, as inspiring and empowering, but a lot of other people wrote and with hopelessness and panic and said that it was overwhelming. And there was this one person who wrote, it was a school teacher from Australia, she wrote, and there were a few other people that I got almost the exact same wording from. She said, "How do I get to hope from here?" And that question really resonated with me. How do we get to hope from here? And, you know, not only on the level of how do we get to hope from here about the problems happening on Midway Island, but sort of more globally. You know, the news seems to be getting worse and worse and worse on all of these different levels. On the amount of carbon releasing into the atmosphere, it's getting worse and worse.
Right.
The rainforests, like the acidification of our oceans, the scientists are getting more and more filled with frustration and despair at their inability to convey to us the urgency of what's happening, and it's getting worse and worse and worse daily. How do we get to hope from here? And I didn't know the answer to that question.
There are some days when I still don't know the answer to that question, and it's true. It's to me doing the work, and I stay very connected to the words of the Dalai Lama, who encourages us to think critically and you know, turn the critical thinking into action. So I get that because I interview people like you all the time, and sometimes it is daunting for me. So I've got to constantly revisit that passion and change and my role in spreading the word because this found me. So I really get that. And so go ahead. I just had to do that little share with you because it's really, it can be daunting.
Well, it is daunting, and I think it's the question of our time, you know. And there's so many ways that we can live in denial of the kind of mounting tidal wave of horror that's happening all around us, and that's what I've been trying to focus my work on all these years. And I realized that for a large number of the people who saw my Midway photographs, it had the exact opposite effect than I had hoped.
Right.
And so I went to some elders, and principally a person who's a national treasure, who I now am so fortunate to say is a close friend of mine, and that's the writer Terry Tempest Williams.
Okay.
And I spent a couple days with her, showing her my photographs, meeting with the students that she was teaching at Dartmouth at the time, and hearing her wisdom on the subject of witnessing and how do we get to hope from here. And she said, I can't give you the answer of how do you get to hope from here. I can't write an essay to go with your work that's going to get any further than the devastation that I feel from seeing these photographs. But she said, go back to the island. Stand in the fire longer.
Oh my God. Go deeper
into the witnessing of this tragedy. And the answer may never come, but that seems to be the only, you know, that was the only idea that she could come up with, and it felt right. And so I did go back and witnessed the birds actually dying, which was even more painful than seeing them at the previous time when they were already dead. And we went back a third time when the babies were hatching from their eggs. And on one hand, it was this experience of profound horror because these incredibly adorable, cute little babies, hundreds of thousands of them are hatching out of their eggs. And we just know what they don't know, which is that just in a few months, hence, their bodies are going to be filled with plastic from the Pacific garbage patch. But there's also something that's wondrous and ecstatically beautiful about being on this tiny island surrounded by a million of these magnificent sentient creatures. You know, the albatross is as big as the eagle. They're huge, powerful, gorgeous, elegant birds who have no fear of humans. And their ecosystem is, you know, their community or culture or whatever you'd call it on the island is so beautiful to see. And when the wind blows across the island, hundreds of thousands of them take to the air and zoom around. And there'd be no reason to do that other than just for the joy of it. They do exactly what we would do if we could fly. They just zoom in the air currents, and the air is so filled with them, it's astonishing. And there's so much joy and beauty and mystery and wonderment to be experienced on Midway that I realized a film had to be made that sort of does the same thing I've been trying to do with my work all these years, is that simultaneously takes a deep look at the horror and a deep look at the beauty and the miracle of it, and kind of fuses those two things together. So I'm in the process of making a film on Midway Island that's going to try to go to that place.
And to me, it's like I don't get emotional on a lot of my shows, and I'm just going to get right through that. But you cannot stand in this fire with you and watch a film like that without feeling it. I would hope that nobody could do that, because Terry's words of wisdom is get back in the fire and do it. I remember one show I did, believe it or not, was with Winona Howder from foodandwaterwatch.org, and the whole show was about fracking. And I took the rest of the day off because I'm like, I've got to somehow figure my protection out, because I feel it with a big green open heart. And Midway, just so that you know, is on my vision board for visiting there. If I can ever have that opportunity, I'm putting it out there to the universe to bring me to Midway, because I think it's important also. So keep on doing what you're doing, and maybe you'll show up there someday and Mrs. Green will greet you. Tell people how hard it is to get there and where it is, because we haven't even set the stage for that. Where is Midway? People are thinking, I know where it is because I follow your work.
Well, Midway is it's in the very middle of the Pacific Ocean. And the Pacific Ocean is the world's largest ocean, 6,000 miles across and as tall. And it actually, if you look on a globe, you can see that the Pacific Ocean occupies one quarter of the Earth's surface. And Midway is very close to the center. It's not exactly at the center, but it's the closest you can get to the center of the Pacific Ocean. And in that position, it's the furthest place away from a continent of anywhere on Earth, including the North Pole. And that's part of why the tragedy that's happening there is so profound. Because, you know, if there were seagulls filled up with plastic on Staten Island,
right, you'd understand it.
But in this incredibly remote place, to have the garbage of the world appearing in such a symbolic and just horrific, you know, inside the stomachs of dead baby birds. I mean, what is more innocent than these little birds who are getting fed by their mothers? And what is more innocent than these mothers who just want to feed their babies? And the you know, just the kind of human horror that's intervening there is beyond surreal.
And I think there's a part of it that when you watch it, for me, you have to believe in the ultimate goodness that's in everyone, that this will touch them, it will not shut them down. And it, the spin, the very deep internal spin, is that I can make a difference in my life with the waste that I create and where I put my trash and what I recycle. I mean, I immediately go to how can I be a stand for something different? And when I put words out about what you're doing, I hopefully inspire people to act and change their habits, not be daunted by the pain of it. We're going to have a break in another 2 minutes, but I want to ask you this. If you feel comfortable answering it, you've done really painful work from my perspective of what you have photographed through your lens for us to share. It's a sacrifice on your part, if you ask me. How do you protect you, Chris Jordan? Is it part of the work you do with the elders? How do you keep that protection so you can keep on doing what you're doing? It's daunting to me.
Well, it is daunting, and I protect myself in a whole bunch of different ways. I work on a weekly basis with a very good therapist who I've been working with for 12 years, and I'm also just in constant contact with wise people.
Right.
You know, I'm also incredibly fortunate to be close friends with a woman named Joanna Macy, who's probably the most respected Buddhist in our hemisphere. And with people like Terry Tempest Williams and Paul Hawken and friends like Luis Hoyos, who's the director of The Cove, and we talk about these issues. And, you know, one thing that I've learned early on in this process from Terry Tempest Williams that's incredibly valuable to me, and I've really got my compass set on this principle, and that is grief is nothing more and nothing less than a felt experience of love for something that we're losing or that we've lost. And so that when we stand in grief, in one way, it's a feeling of pain, but really, on a deeper level, it's a feeling of love. And where I'm aiming my Midway project is for the viewer to experience this felt experience of love for something that they didn't even know existed.
Let's come back on that. Yeah, we've got to take a break, and let's hold that thought. Sorry to break the energy.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Hi, this is Mrs. Green with some great news about the all-new 2012 VW Passat. It's 2012 Motor Trend Car of the Year, best in class for legroom, and has standard Bluetooth technology. VW thought of everything by giving the Passat a brand new sleek design that conveys confidence and assertiveness. If you're looking for the best ownership experience possible and a great new Passat, visit Chapman Tucson at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan.
What if you had simple and easy solutions to live, work, and play green? Green Living Magazine, the premier green lifestyle magazine, brings you the latest in organic cooking, gardening, health and wellness, chef and celebrity interviews, as well as easy solutions to clean up your everyday life. Visit greenlivingaz.com for the latest in green news. Buy your subscription and view our network videos. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and again at greenlivingaz.com.
Can academic research really save the planet? This year, the University of Arizona took full ownership of Biosphere 2. With 5 ecosystems enclosed in over 7 million cubic feet of sealed glass, Biosphere 2 is a premier facility for environmental research, where the top minds in the world will come together to address some of humanity's greatest challenges, such as climate change. Now that's using your brains. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Budweiser is asking guys to skip shaving leading up to World Environment Day. Not only can guys get an extra 5 minutes of sleep in the morning, they can save about 5 gallons of water for each shave they skip. Our goal is to save 1 million gallons of water. Help us by going to Budweiser's Facebook page and making a pledge. You can actually do less and help make a difference. So join us and grow one. Save a million.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to, which is such an exciting possibility for me. And our guest today is Chris Jordan, who is an internationally acclaimed environmental photographer and more recently filmmaker. Chris is working on a film called Midway Film. You can see it at midwayfilm.com. And I just want to do a quick shout out about next week's show, because I know we're going to go with this show right up to the last second. We have the National Resources Defense Council food scientist Dana Gunders and one of the Growing Green Team award winners, Andrea Northrup, who is the founder of the DC Farm to School Network. So it's going to be an exciting show next Saturday. And Chris, I apologize for asking that question when I know better. I've been doing this. This is not my first rodeo. And to ask such a contemplative, deep question of you and then to go to break, I apologize for that. So if we can get back to it, I would like to segue. I was asking Chris, if you just joined me, what protection does he put around himself to keep him inspired to do the work that he's doing? And I'm sorry, I love your answers, and I hope you can just articulate that a little bit more, because I think it's important for all of us being called to do the work.
Well, I would love to talk more deeply about it, and I only have one technical problem in it, and that is the battery in my phone is just about to go dead. So can I talk with someone there and give them my cell phone number so you guys can
yes,
call
you,
me?
Yes, you can tell me right on the air, and we can call you back on that number. It's not a problem because it's my show. That's the beauty of it. It's not Clear Channel Radio.
So, well, I'd kind of rather not have lots
of people. Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. You're right. Okay. We can go on a... Yes. We'll put you on hold, and our James will pick up and get your number. Okay. All right. So that was... There you go. Where he's off the air. The world does not want to know Chris Jordan's cell phone number. There is cause for humor. And on this little break, please remember to check me out on Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest. It's really fun to see the numbers growing and to all of you helping me spread the good green word. And don't forget that you can listen on your iPhone or Droid. And the other little shout out is remember that if you do miss the show, our podcast live on my website at mrsgreensworld.com. We've got a great contest going on with Miraval for mindful eating, eat well, be well, and you can actually win a stay at Miraval, which, as you know, is one of my favorite places on the planet for all the right reasons, sustainability from the inside out. So we have Chris Jordan back. We did not put his number out on the internet. Chris, that cracks me up. It's like, yeah, no, you don't want to say your cell phone for all of the international community. Thanks you for reminding that of me. I'm really focused on your message.
Okay. Well, now we can continue. Sorry about that.
I'll laugh about that for a while.
Well, we were talking about the power of grief. And,
yes.
I have really come to believe deeply in the power of feeling generally, you know, whether it's a feeling of anger or a feeling of fear or a feeling of sadness that we have about what's happening to our world. We tend to distance ourselves from our feelings, especially those feelings that we have been conditioned or socialized to believe are bad feelings. You know, because I've always been taught since I was little that if you're sad, there's something wrong. You know, that's a bad feeling. Or if you're angry that there's something wrong and you need to get over it and get back to being fine again. And so it's hard to kind of shift into the belief and the understanding that feeling angry and feeling frightened and feeling sad are very natural and legitimate responses to what's happening to our world right now.
And so important that we do that and not put the barrier up. Just feel it.
Yeah. And in fact, I think it's alarming when we aren't feeling those things.
Not a problem for me. And I just want to tell you a little story about an elder very quickly. I had a medicine man tell me a long time ago, I cried very easily. And everybody's saying, you're not going to cry, are you? Oh, don't cry. You're going to get Gina crying. Well, he said to me, honor your tears because you cry for those of us who can't. So when people say that to me now, I say, no, these are tears of joy, or it's really important, and the world would be a better place if more people cry. And that's exactly in sync with what you're saying. I feel it. I mean, I feel it, and then my face shows it, and then the tears start. And sometimes I don't even know I'm crying. And I'm honoring that, embracing it, and using it in my walk as Mrs. Green. So I just had to do that little bit of a shout-out. So go on.
Well, yeah, I mean, when we're in touch with our feelings about what's happening to the world, then we're in connection with the world. I mean, our feelings are our connection with the world. And they're also our connection with the deepest part of our own selves. And so when we're able to feel our grief for what is being lost every day, then we're in touch with the deepest part of ourself, which is the part of ourself that carries wisdom. And I think that's the great disconnect that's happening in our world right now for a whole bunch of different reasons. We're losing touch with what we feel. And one of the reasons is because of the nature of the information. You know, I think we're also overwhelmed with the information that we're receiving via the internet, you know, this brand new technology that it's really hard to comprehend these issues, you know, like global climate change. The scientists are telling us it's this profoundly important issue, but the only information we have to try to understand global climate change is these numbers like 9 gigatons of carbon released in the atmosphere last year.
And nobody knows what that means. Nobody knows what that means, unless you're a scientist. I totally agree.
It's really hard to feel anything when we're relating to this information in such an abstract way. And that, to me, is one of the power of the story, the kind of epic, lyrical, mythological story of what's happening out on Midway Island is that in the presence of these birds and their incredible beauty and also the horror of what's happening, it's easy to connect with what we feel.
How did you handle, and I really do want to talk about the film, and I'd love to know the timing for it and where you are in terms of expecting a release and how I can help with my network. But you literally, I want to paint a picture for people. You're filmed literally picking parts, teeny, teeny parts of metal and plastic out of the stomachs of the dead babies. That's a big level of protection. That's the point at which I said, okay, I have to keep watching this because it's really important, because I need to help spread the word. So at what point did you decide I can do that? Was it your commitment to standing in the fire and really, I mean, really feeling it for all of us so that we could feel it too?
Well, I did make a commitment to myself to fully witness the tragedy. And it's just been a process of sort of going deeper and deeper into it. And the first time we opened up a freshly dead bird, you know, we watched this bird die in front of us in what was obviously agony. And when it had finished dying and we filmed up very close, the very last time that its eye blinked, and I put my hand on its breast and felt its heart stop beating. And we all sat around, and then it wasn't anything that I had planned, that it had ever even occurred to me before, but we all sat around and like, well, what do we do next? And this horrible sort of dawning realization happened. Oh my God, we have to open it up. And it's just been a process like that. The story just sort of keeps coming to me, and my commitment is to not turn away. You know, and it's sort of like if you think of the hero's journey, you know, everybody's on their own personal hero's journey. And if you think of, like, what does the hero do? You know, the hero gets the sword and runs through finds the cave and slays the monsters and finally gets to the dragon's den. And in that story, the dragon is 10 times bigger than the hero ever imagined. And what does the hero do right then? Turn around and run away? You know, I mean, I can't think of any other course anymore than to just dive more and more deeply and to trust that my heart can be broken 1,000 times and that I'll still be here the next day.
And it did find you. Midway is going to be such an important, the film is going to be so important, so on purpose. There's no question in my mind. I mean, I've already sent it out to a bunch of people from just looking at the clip. How are you, what's the response been for support of it? It's so, just to get to Midway, I don't even know how you get there. Do you fly to Hawaii? Do you then, I mean, it's 2,000 miles in the middle of nowhere, literally. You don't just go to Midway. So in terms of literally the cost for producing this, that is a message of such profound importance, how can people help support it? What would be the call to action that would help you the most to make this possible for all of us?
Well, thank you so much for asking that. It is very expensive to get to Midway, and especially with high-end video gear and my whole crew of guys. we got a permit a while back. You have to have a permit to go to the island.
Right.
And what we basically do is hitchhike on a government plane that goes back and forth every week or every 2 weeks, because Midway, it's run as a wildlife sanctuary. So there's some fish and wildlife biologists there who study the birds, and there's a small crew of people who run a little, like a little hotel kind of thing. And there's electricity in the island. So it, you know, when we're working there, it's not so physically difficult as it might be in somewhere like Antarctica.
Right.
But it's very, very expensive to get there. And the process of the film has been a real challenge, because we started out making a kind of standard documentary film, which really would have only taken us maybe one or two trips to the island to get everything we needed. And, you know, at the beginning it was, you know, like putting a lavalier mic on me, and I would do an interview with the camera, and then we
right.
would talk to the biologists, and sort of like standard documentary film style. And the more time I spent out on the island, the more this lyrical, poetic, kind of mythological story began to present itself, of just the incredible beauty and complexity and of these birds. And so we kind of ramped up our production value and started taking really high-quality cameras with us, and realized we have to have top-quality footage of the birds hatching from their eggs. And so we had to make an entire trip just during that two-week period to get the hatching, and then during the mating dances. And so it's turned into kind of more like a full production film project.
Yeah, it's a whole nother level. I mean, in a really, really tough spot. I get it. I really get it. So how can people help? Are you literally, can people donate to help support the cause?
Well, here's another little tiny piece of background around that. People can donate, and I would really love it if that would happen, because once the project is finished, once we have a film in our hands, I don't want to owe anybody any money, you know, and I don't want to have a bunch of investors looking over my shoulder wanting to
right. I get
a profit.
It.
Because what I want to do is gift this film to the world, and reach the largest possible audience that we can reach, independently of the need to make any money. And so I'm really hoping to fund it through a Kickstarter project that we're going to be starting soon. We currently have a donation button on our trailer.
Okay.
That people can donate to the film. But if we can fund it that way, then by the time we're finished, then I can sit down with a group of social media expert friends of mine, and we can think kind of radically and creatively about how to gift this project to the world without having to worry at all about making revenue. So if you and your readers can help us sort of spread the message that we do need funding, and we need a lot. For a documentary film, it's a lot of money.
A lot of money.
It's about $1.5 million that we need. But we think that it's not unreasonable to project that we have the ability to reach 1 billion people with this film. We're going to translate it into Mandarin and Urdu, Hindi, and a whole bunch of other languages, and just put it out there for global viewership. And so when you look at it that way, a budget of $1 million to reach 1 billion people, that's 1,000 viewers for every dollar that we spend on the film.
I know. It's you're running the numbers again, and I love it. Thanks for running those numbers. So I will shockingly tell you that we have about a minute left, and I there's no surprise at all here that this was going to happen, that I have a page and a half more questions. And I just want to thank you and honor you for the footprint you have left on my life and in my journey as Mrs. Green's, because Mrs. Green's World, which is a global reach, growing, and to tell you, we'll help in any way we can. We'll help pump up the volume. And people, you can go to chrisjordan.com. Clearly, after listening to this interview, you will want to, and read about, learn about, and become a part of his both tragedy and beauty that he has as a vision for our planet. Chris, thank you. Thank your family. thank all the people that are doing the work that you're doing and your elders, and I honor you for this work. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for the work you're doing.
Thanks for being a part of this, and hopefully you'll come back, and it won't be 4 years.
All right.
We'll get on it. Okay. Thanks and blessings to everyone. Make it a great green week, and talk to you next Saturday right here, MrsGreensWorld.com.